From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. With war in Iraq changing from overthrow to pacification and tensions flaring elsewhere in the world, many are calling for more troops. Addressing the Senate Tuesday, General Peter Shoemaker, President Bush's nominee for Army Chief of Staff, said, "I think we need more people. It's that simple." Tonight on Point is the American Army being pushed to its limits. We begin in Baghdad. Since President Bush declared an end to major combat on May the 1st, 52 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq, including two more today. Earlier, I spoke to Anne Scott Tyson, Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her about the circumstances surrounding the death of the two American soldiers today.
My understanding is there was an armored personnel carrier headed out to Baghdad International Airport that ran over a mine, and I believe one soldier was killed and some others wounded. At the same time, yesterday, some soldiers came under fire to the northeast of Baghdad. I believe it was small arms fire that also killed some soldiers from the 4th Infantry Division.
The laying of landmines, is that a new development?
No, it's been going on. They tend to monitor the troops' frequent travel, and they tend to bury the mines maybe in a dirt spot in the road, say, where vehicles would turn, you know, would tend to veer off of the main, any paved road, and that is how they've been successful in the past.
Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the commander of coalition troops in Iraq, remains upbeat despite continuing deaths amongst American soldiers.
Yes, the commanders will say that because although it may sound incredibly callous to them, these incidents are not what they would consider militarily significant, meaning that there are sporadic attacks, there are ongoing casualties, but certainly nothing high in number, nothing that really shows a very sophisticated, coordinated attacks that would do far greater damage. I mean, there are some successful attacks, but there are also a lot of just sort of hit-and-run attacks that aren't very carefully done. I mean, even cases where they fail to pull the pin on, say, the RPG, and so, you know, they'll fire things off that won't even explode. That sort of thing happens that gives them a reading on the enemy. But, of course, it's always very significant, but in terms of if you're looking at an overall campaign, it's horrible to have casualties, but from their point of view, I'm just repeating their point of view, it is not really militarily significant.
But is the view of the troops somewhat different?
The soldiers I've spent time with lately have been from the 101st Airborne Division up in the northern part of Iraq around Mosul, and those from the 4th Infantry Division around Tikrit, as well as those from the 1st Armored Division who are in Baghdad. Clearly, they're on their guard. Their force protection measures have been stepped up, required numbers of vehicles on convoys and things like that. But at the same time, they know they're going to be here for a while. And as one soldier put it to me in Mosul, they simply cannot afford to let their guard down. They have to keep going, keep trying, keep alert, and keep doing their job as well as they can to try to ensure that they and their soldiers beneath them will come home safely.
I mean, one would expect them to continue to do a professional job, but at the same time, do you sense an irritation that they're having to stay in Iraq for maybe longer than they had anticipated?
I think there are clearly mixed feelings about that. I mean, especially among units that fought in the war. Some of them have come more recently and haven't been deployed for quite as long. Certainly, the 3rd Infantry Division had seriously low morale, and they are headed back. I think that, I mean, in the States, you might get a little bit of a mixed picture or a distorted picture because all you hear about are the daily attacks. Iraq is a big country. There are a lot of soldiers here. There are a lot of soldiers every day who are going out, interacting with Iraqis, doing various projects, doing things that, while they'd much rather be home, of course, are positive and sometimes very positive for them. And so it's sort of a mixture, and it's always incredibly hard when they lose a comrade, but it's not all doom and gloom.
But they've been able, have they, those soldiers, for the most part, to make that transition from fighter to peacekeeper?
It's a challenge for them, and sometimes it can be amusing. They'll get into these odd situations to laugh about. You'll have a young captain managing a local election or informing a court that they have to abolish the death penalty. They're just into an incredible range of activities that certainly is testing all their leadership skills and sort of flexibility. In many cases, they're simply the only ones on the ground available to do these jobs, and I think they're trying to make the best of it.
I mean, have any of the soldiers you've spoken to told you or intimated that they might actually be rethinking their military careers after their experience in Iraq?
Yes, there have been some. I mean, it's hard to really categorize, but reservists, for example, there are some types of soldiers who are very much in demand in Iraq now, especially civil affairs units, those ones that typically interact, go out and try to get information and get projects going with the local population, the rebuilding types of things. This is their mission. Now, those units are almost exclusively drawn out of the reserves. Some of those people have also already been deployed in Afghanistan. Now, I think they were not bargaining for this when they signed up. And so, particularly among reservists, you have second thoughts about reenlistment.
Anne Scott Tyson, many thanks for that.
My pleasure.
Anne Scott Tyson is a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from Baghdad. With the conflict in Iraq now a long-term campaign, many feel the American military is being pushed to its limit. Facing an ongoing war on terror, the occupation of Afghanistan, and tensions mounting in North Korea and elsewhere, the army may be living beyond its means. And if the mission in Iraq discourages soldiers from re-enlisting, the army's numbers problem could become crisis. Is the American military being pushed to its limit? If it's overstretched, is the solution more troops or less conflict? Does America need a new kind of army for the 21st century? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now in the studio is Ern Cote, Associate Director of the Security Study Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome, Owen. Iraq first. Has the United States overcommitted itself in Iraq in a way that maybe it had not anticipated before the outbreak of this conflict?
The basic lay of the land is that it can be very confusing to talk about the army, and the best way to talk about the army is to talk about brigades, because brigades are sort of the sort of common denominator, the units that engage in combat. It's where, you know, it's how the army thinks about what they need for a given problem. And basically half of the army's brigades are either in Iraq or in Afghanistan. 16 are in Iraq and one is in Afghanistan. That's a total of 33. So you say, well, that's just half of what is still a large force that's left over. And the problem in Iraq especially is that for every one of those 16 brigades that's there now, there are, hopefully, you would want in the ideal world 16 brigades that are getting ready to replace them within about 6 months, starting in about 6 months. And then those 16 that, as they come home, you want in the ideal world for them to be, have 6 months, 8 months, 9 months to recover, have their equipment repaired, to sort of spend some time with their families that they haven't seen for a while. And so there's kind of a rule of thumb that says that if you have a brigade somewhere, you should have two other brigades in the force structure to support it in this kind of rotation scheme. So you can see that we're not even close to what we need to sustain the presence we have in Iraq and Afghanistan, and mostly Iraq drives that, for any length of time, because what will happen is that the deployments will have to be extended, and that's bad for morale. You get to year-long deployments, things like that. And so yeah, no one disputes that there's a basic structural problem for the army here.
So if half of the American brigades are in Iraq, how are the others deployed elsewhere in the world?
There are two in Korea. There are two left in Europe. Some of the brigades that normally live in Europe are actually in Iraq. Like I said before, there's one in Afghanistan, and there are 12 that are basically in the U.S., and three of those have just come back – two of those have just come back from somewhere and are unavailable, and one of them is unavailable because it's in the midst of this transformational process that we may talk about later. So there are 9 brigades in the U.S. that are kind of available in principle for activity, and you can see that 9 don't replace 16, for example.
And could the problem be sorted out by a shuffling of the pack?
Well, what's already happened, the Army announced this, I think, earlier this week, which is that there's going to be an effort to get more allied involvement on the ground in Iraq, with a lot of issues associated with that we can talk about. It's far from guaranteed to be successful. There's already been a decision made to call up some National Guard brigades, which we haven't done up till now. It's important for the readers to understand that we've called up a lot of reservists, but they are these kinds of people that Anne was talking about. They're civil affairs people, they're military policemen, they're transportation specialists. There are these actual brigade-type combat units that are in the National Guard that we haven't touched yet, and so we're going to call 2 of those up. That is a very, very significant step. And that's a relatively small call up, and that doesn't solve the problem. So that's the second thing. And the third thing is the Marines, who are smaller than the Army, but have generally avoided this kind of duty, may be in for a lot of this kind of duty in the coming months and years.
So the bottom line, certainly in Iraq, is that the United States needs to be able to spread the load there.
It absolutely has to. There is just no way for the Army to sustain the rate of deployment it has now over the time frames that the administration itself is now saying is entirely possible here. For 2 years, 3 years, the kind of numbers that people are throwing around, it's impossible for the Army to sustain that the way it is now.
And do you have a sense that this probably wasn't very carefully thought out, the extent to which the United States would become committed militarily in Iraq?
There's just a fantastic proof of the degree to which this was not expected, which was the outgoing Chief of Staff of the Army, Eric Shinseki, testified in Congress in the immediate I'm hazy about the date exactly, but I think in the immediate aftermath of the end of combat operations when they were declared by the president, that we would need to have several hundred thousand troops in Iraq for a considerable amount of time. And both Secretary Rumsfeld and Secretary Wolfowitz said publicly that it was absolutely absurd to argue that it might take more troops to pacify and nation build in Iraq than it took to win the war. Well, it's been demonstrated already that he was right and they were wrong.
So major rethink, you think, going on of Rumsfeld's doctrine of military transformation?
Well, there's two sides to that coin. I mean, as far as the war is concerned, Rumsfeld and the other planners took a gamble about the size of the force that they were going to commit. And from my perspective, they got away with it this time. And so if you're talking about fighting wars and doing it in different ways than you have in the past, then this experience can confirm that. But what gets left out of that equation is what happens when you win the war. And peacekeeping or pacification or nation building, whatever the term is that you want to use, is not an endeavor that plays to our strong suit. We have no big advantage as a country and as an army in that area compared to anyone else because it's very low tech, it's very people intensive, and it involves a lot of skills that you can acquire them, but there's nothing about a revolution in military affairs that's going on here.
And of course, this is an administration that set its heart against the notion of peacekeeping and indeed nation building.
Well, and if it weren't for 9/11, I suspect we wouldn't be doing it on the scale that we are now. Their interpretation of that event was to take a different perspective on that, at least as far as Iraq is concerned. And so they're going to be engaged in nation building on a scale that was beyond their view of Bill Clinton's wildest dreams.
Oh, and we must take a break. Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Study Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're talking tonight about whether the American military is being pushed to its limit. Is the army overstretched? If so, then is the solution more troops or less conflict? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking whether the American military is overstretched. Could the U.S. fight another war right now? If it had to, does America need a new type of army for the 21st century? Can you imagine building it in today's economy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Securities Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And joining us now from Larchmont, New York, is Max Boot, Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. Welcome, Max Boot.
Thank you.
Can I ask you, first of all, whether you feel that the U.S. military is currently overstretched?
Yes, I agree with everything that your previous guests have said. They're absolutely correct. There's no way that our current level of deployments is sustainable given our current force structure. I don't think there's any way to avoid the fact that we need to increase the size of the active duty military. In fact, I would argue that we basically need to increase to the same size military that we had the last time we fought a war in Iraq, which was 1991. At that point, we had 18 active duty army divisions. Today, we have roughly 10 active duty army divisions. That is a huge fall that occurred in the 1990s when we were confident there was a peace dividend that we could spend and that we didn't have to spend so much on our defense. But now we realize that it is a very dangerous world after all, despite the end of the Cold War, and we actually have bigger commitments abroad militarily than we did during the Cold War. So I think that we just have to go back and bite the bullet, so to speak, and increase the size of the military to the point where they're able to do all the jobs that have been assigned to them.
And is that something that the United States can afford to do at the moment?
Well, if you look at the sheer numbers, the answer is absolutely yes. The best way to gauge military spending is as a percentage of GDP, as a percentage of what the overall economy generates. You can't look at the figures in isolation because it's like saying, is a meal expensive or not? Well, a $100 meal might be very expensive to a minimum wage worker, but to Bill Gates, he doesn't notice it, right? So it really depends on what your income level is, what you can afford. And at the moment, the United States is spending 3.5% of our GDP on defense, 3.5%. That is not very high. In 1991, the year that I'm talking about, we were spending 4.6% of our GDP, which is much closer to our historic average during the years of the Cold War, actually a little bit low. But 4.6 to 3.5 doesn't sound like a big dip, but measured as a percentage of our huge economy, that's many, many billions of dollars. And so I think we can easily afford to spend more, especially when we are in a very dire situation where we're facing a lot of threats around the world. And I think that the American people realize there's a war on terrorism going on. I think they would be willing to spend what it takes to fight it properly.
But do you really need to increase the overall size of the U.S. military, or might it be possible to redeploy troops from other parts of the world where they're not necessarily needed? What, 40,000 troops in Japan?
It's hard to find a lot of parts of the world where they're not needed. Everybody thinks that they're needed. I mean, the reason why we have so many troops in Japan, most of those are on Okinawa. They are there as part of the war plans for dealing with North Korea. I don't think this is the right moment, given the way that North Korean nuclear program is advancing, to pull those troops out. Nor can we pull troops out of Afghanistan or Bosnia or Kosovo. It's really hard to figure out any place where they're not needed. In fact, we're seeing more calls all the time for more U.S. troops in places like Liberia, not for pulling them out, but for putting more in. And given that reality, I think we do have to increase the overall size of the military. And I think President Bush has been irresponsible for not pressing that issue more strongly.
Owen Cote, do you see, though, Congress being receptive to the idea of increasing the size of the U.S. military?
Well, Max makes a very good point, which is that from a domestic political economic sense, the United States doesn't carry a heavy burden in military terms compared to its GDP, compared to historic great powers or empires or what have you. That's absolutely right. What is absolutely also right is that as you look at the ebb and flow of defense spending in the Cold War and then after the Cold War, as he was talking about, it went down and you you know, you see these ebb and flows, and it's 3%, it's 4%, and so on and so forth. One thing has been going up inexorably, which is another part of the budget, which is basically the cost of paying for an aging population. And so it's true that there's a lot of money in the United States, and there's a lot of you know, there's a lot available for all sorts of things. But if you cut taxes a lot, and if you're the cost of paying for elderly, both retirement and medicine, is going up, 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 and up, you do get a squeeze. You're going to get deficits, or you're going to have to raise taxes again.
Let's take a call from Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Mike, what do you want to say?
I just want to say that we disagree with this whole idea of spreading the American domination around the world. We used to say in Nam, we used to say one too many Vietnams, and there's going to be a bounty on American scalps all around this world. And one more thing, when the lieutenant was trying to sabotage and endanger us in Nam, there was an expression, we'd fag him. And now I think these governors and these billionaires are trying to endanger the people of America, and I think we ought to learn a lesson of what to do with these dangerous military-industrial people. Thank you for this.
Max Boot, let me put that one to you. A lot of anger there in that call from Mike. But underlying it, I think, an anxiety that the U.S. is setting itself up as a global policeman and setting the rules.
Well, I think we have to, because the great threat to the United States doesn't come from the military-industrial complex, as the caller would have it. It comes from people like Osama bin Laden, who want to kill a lot of Americans. And pulling our troops out from various places around the world is not going to placate them. In fact, it'll send the opposite message, which is that we are weak or a paper tiger, as Osama bin Laden said in the 1990s, when in fact we were pulling out of a lot of places. It encouraged them to keep on attacking us. And I would just remind the caller that on where did Osama bin Laden's murderous henchman attack on September 11th, 2001? Of course, one of their targets was the Pentagon, the center of our military. But the other target was the World Trade Center, the center of our commercial activity. You can talk about pulling military troops out of various places, but are we seriously going to pull out all of our businesses, all of the economic activities, all the things that underpin the prosperity that America has come to take for granted? That is obviously impossible. And we would never do that. We are the greatest beneficiaries of an open and global free trading order. Given all that being the case, we have to defend ourselves. And giving in to people like Osama bin Laden is not going to save us. We have to deal with them very sternly. We have to fight a war that's and win a war that's been declared against us.
Owen Cote, we touched a little earlier on this notion of the United States spreading the load. Certainly in Iraq, it could very easily do that with the United Nations. There is a peacekeeping role there, as well as ongoing combat operations. The two kinds of operations coexist in Afghanistan.
Well, here's what the situation there is, which is that if you want to get some help from the countries that can contribute, most of them are saying they want a UN resolution blessing the provisional government that the United States has installed. And they also want to have a lot more say about what's going to go on in the country, you know, if they are going to get involved. And it's not clear to me that the Bush administration is willing to make that trade to get a lot more help in return for some reduced control. But that's sort of what the argument is right now.
But why shouldn't the United Nations share a greater load?
I'm not saying they shouldn't, but what I'm saying is the natural, if you're the French, right, and the Bush administration comes to you and says, we'd like 25,000 troops to come and help us with this problem, you're going to say, well, I want a voice in what the future of Iraq is going to be. And they've made it clear that that's what they want. That's what the Indians have said. That's what the whole list of people. And the other problem is that there are limits to how much these people can contribute. They can help, but we're not going to get in a situation where we hand that off to them. This will continue to be a major commitment for us. It won't be 16 brigades, but you know, it'll be some number that's not the norm. That's for sure.
Micah's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What's on your mind, Micah?
Well, I was going to say that increasing the size of the military is kind of just what we need to do. It's a good Keynesian solution to our economic problem. And although I agree with Mike from Madison that this whole thing is kind of goofy adventurism, I mean, I'd rather have them planting trees. But given our administration, this is the only kind of public works we're going to get. So we're going to go kill brown-skinned people, you know? That's our public works.
So you're saying that it's not a question of the United States not being able to afford this, but increasing the size of the military would give the economy a boost.
Yeah.
I'm not an economist, and I'd love for Max to weigh on this, but I think that, you know, if you step up to the problem and you say you're willing to raise taxes to do this, and you'd have to raise them a lot, that would be an economic boost. There's no question about it. There's, you know, a big debate about whether it's wise to raise government spending and not bring the revenues up so that you start running these big deficits again. And that's beyond my canon. If Max wants to comment on that, that's, you know, go ahead. But there's no question that increasing defense spending is a great way to prime the pump, all other things being equal. That's true.
Max Boot?
Well, sure. There would definitely be some stimulative effect from it, of course. You know, I'm not sure what the net economic outcome would be, but if we're going to be able to afford larger defense spending, I think we definitely would have to make some sacrifices. One of those sacrifices would probably be less in the way of tax cuts, but another sacrifice would be not to push through this massive expansion of Medicare, which is now going through, which would create a vast new entitlement for prescription drugs, which it's estimated would balloon out to something like 9% of GDP within 50 years. So that's a huge cost structure that we're fixing on ourselves. And I think there's hypocrisy on both sides to go around here, because President Bush wants a lot. He wants more spending on defense, but he also wants tax cuts. And Democrats say they want more spending on peacekeeping and nation building, but they also want this giant Medicare entitlement. And so neither side is really willing to make much of a sacrifice at this point in order to allow us to afford our defense commitments. And I think we have to get a little bit more realistic about our obligations.
Now, I asked the question, more U.S. troops, a bigger American army, or less conflict? And this was a war in Iraq that was described at the time as a preemptive strike. I mean, and that was essentially a political decision, wasn't it, Max Boot?
Well, there's no question about it. I think President Bush was fairly clear about why he was going in. He admitted that there was no imminent threat of an Iraqi attack. He was clear about that in his infamous State of the Union address, but he said that, you know, his perception and many people's perception of possible threats had been changed by 9/11, and so now his feeling was that facing the prospect of attacks with terrorism and attacks with weapons of mass destruction, we could no longer wait to be hit and then retaliate afterwards, that we would have to be preemptive and go out there and shape the world in ways that would reduce the dangers to us. Now, whatever you might think about that rationale, the bottom line is we are committed in Iraq, and now that we are committed, we have to make a go of it. And I think Democrats, Republicans, liberal conservatives, whoever, I think we all can basically agree on that having gotten in, the best way to get out is to create a more liberal and democratic Iraq, but that's not going to be easy, and it's going to take a long-term commitment. And so there's no easy way we can just escape this and say, oh, you know, sorry, it was all a big misunderstanding, and we're leaving Iraq. I mean, we're in there to stay, and we're in Afghanistan and various other places. So I think we have to do the best possible attempt that we can make to set those countries straight.
Okay, also with us now from Washington is Lawrence Korb, Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1985. Welcome, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you.
Mr. Korb, the generals are really putting their heads above the parapet in this debate. As somebody who was inside track at the Pentagon at one time, they must be seriously worried.
Well, yeah, you got to be, because, you know, whenever you go into any type of situation, you have to plan for the best, and plan for the worst and hope for the best. And it's clear to me in terms of the reconstruction, we're planning for the best. And now we've got ourselves into a situation where we're going to have to spend a lot of money for a long period of time. We're going to have a lot more Americans killed than we thought. And if we don't get some help from the international community, this is all going to fall on the American taxpayer and the American fighting man and women.
Does the United States have enough troops, given the current way in which they're pinned down in Iraq and elsewhere in the world, to fight a war, for instance, against North Korea tomorrow?
Well, they certainly can. The problem you have in Iraq is you don't have enough troops or you have the right kind of troops. I mean, we should have many more military police and civil affairs battalions. And for years, people have been telling the military that you need to get these peacekeeping type of forces out of the reserves and onto active duty. They haven't done that. They've been worried about other things. And so now you have a situation where you've got some of your best fighting forces basically doing police work. And that's really not an efficient use of the force.
Okay, Sadiq is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Sadiq, what did you want to say?
I'm really amazed by the way that language is manipulated by the Bush administration. First, it was going into Iraq around the weapons of mass destruction, none been found. Then we're told, and you know, I'm making reference to the UN situation. Then we're told, no, this is not an occupation. We're just liberating the Iraqi people, and once they've established themselves, we will leave. I mean, it's a blatant lie. The bottom line is that the UN is sitting there right now, and first of all, our troops are in danger there because they're the ones face-to-face with the Iraqi people. So that's all they see is the infidels, the Americans. All they have to do is go to the UN, get a resolution passed. India said, we'll send 17,000. Jordan said, so in other words, the reduced numbers of folks there, an international force, lessen the hostility, and the United States could... But see, the reality is that this country is trying to make Iraq the 51st state. They have no intentions. You're right. They don't want to relinquish any power. They want to control it. They want to establish a puppet government over there and control it. I was listening to a retired general today on CNN. He said that he was informed that they intend to set up 22 bases in Iraq. So that doesn't sound to me like someone who's trying to liberate a country. You're going to occupy it and then just suck it dry. And, I just think the gullibility of the people in this country to accept this lingo day in and day out, it's exasperating.
Lawrence Cobb?
Well, I think I agree with the caller in one point. We need to internationalize this as quickly as we can. I mean, Senator Biden put it well. This is not some prize that we won. The international community shares our goals to have a peaceful, free Iraq that's able to make its own decisions. And we need to swallow our pride, get us another UN resolution. And as the caller pointed out, if you had a UN resolution, the UN had more say in what was going on, the Indians would have sent a division. That would have been 15,000 people that would have relieved our troops. And I think if we had a UN resolution, we could get the bigger powers in Europe, Germany and France, be willing to send some troops there. Not only would it relieve us, they're better at it than we are. They have the gendarmes and the Italians have the carabinieri, which are basically this is the type of work they do, and they do very well.
Lawrence Cobb, we must take a break. Lawrence Cobb, Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with me, Max Boot, Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're discussing whether the American military is being pushed to its limit. Is the experience in Iraq showing us that the U.S. can do more with less, or that occupation requires more troops than combat? Does America need a new kind of army for the 21st century? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about whether the U.S. military is being overstretched, and if so, is the answer more troops or less conflict? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Study Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Max Boot, Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Lawrence Cobb, Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and former Assistant Secretary of Defense. Owen Cote, there seems to be a general recognition that the U.S. military is overstretched at the moment. Do you think it is shaping foreign policy in any way? Is it making, for instance, Washington less willing to engage North Korea, knowing that it might not be able to take it on? Is it making it less willing to send peacekeepers to Liberia?
Well, certainly in the latter case,
I don't think there was much there's much enthusiasm for something like Liberia in this administration under any circumstances. I think there's obviously much less now. As far as North Korea is concerned, it's an interesting question as to what the situation would be if we weren't bogged down in Iraq. But, of course, we are. And what's ironic about that is that just within the logic of the axis of evil strategy itself, why, if it's pretty clear that on the nuclear front, Iraq was miles and miles and miles behind where North Korea already was, you know, a year or two ago, why would you take this step that basically pins down half of the army, and we haven't talked about the other services, but it's almost as bad, right at the point when it's clear that, it's kind of the decisive point as far as North Korea is concerned. They've broken out of the 94 agreement. We believe they're producing plutonium now. There's lots of speculation they're already producing some highly enriched uranium. We're not as sure about that. We have many fewer military options right now, and many would argue that we really don't have any serious ones vis-a-vis North Korea, given the extent to which we're pinned down in Iraq right now.
Max Boot, effective diplomacy must be backed by a credible threat of force. Does the United States have that at the moment?
Well, to some extent, sure. I mean, it's true that a huge portion of our military is pinned down in Iraq, but during the latest Iraq war, we saw how a relatively small American force can have a huge, huge impact because the lethality of American forces has just increased tremendously because of technological advances over the past decade. Now, that said, obviously we're limited in what we can do right now because we do have such a high portion of our forces deployed. But even if we hadn't gone into Iraq, I'm not sure how that would substantially change our stance vis-a-vis North Korea. I'm not sure we would be any more eager for a military confrontation with North Korea, even if we had all those 16 brigades that are in Iraq free to use against North Korea. We still wouldn't want to do that because the real danger with North Korea is not the conventional part of the war, which we would win, and I think win pretty handily. The real danger is, A, in the early stages of the war, North Korea has thousands of artillery tubes zeroed in on Seoul, and they would destroy a huge part of that city before we could do anything about it. And B, North Korea already probably has some nuclear weapons which they could use. So those are the real threats, and those are not susceptible to an easy conventional military solution. So we have a real dilemma with North Korea, but I'm not sure that it's affected that much by the fact that we have all these forces deployed in Iraq.
Lawrence Korb, do you think that the United States currently has the military clout to back up its diplomatic demands?
Well, I think it has the military clout. The problem is that it's got its attention riveted in the wrong place. I think Owen made a terrific point. I mean, if you were looking at what was the most dangerous thing, certainly North Korea would have been more dangerous than Iraq. And what happened, basically, we said, look, we got our attention focused on Iraq, and first administration first said North Korea wasn't a problem, and they just sort of let it drift all of the last couple of months while they were so consumed with what's going on in Iraq. I think Max is right. In a military confrontation, I think the South Koreans could beat the North Koreans. It would just be what would the cost be in terms of lives lost in Seoul with the initial artillery barrage.
Ed's calling from Chicago, Illinois. Ed, what do you want to say?
Well, I wanted to also challenge the word defense when we talk about defense spending, because I think we have we have plenty of resources to defend our country. But what I think we're doing in Iraq is offensive, in that we're going into a country mainly to acquire an alternate supply of petroleum. We saw that the Saudi Arabians, who now it appears were clearly behind 9/11, they're in real trouble over there, and you know, basically our economy can't survive without that oil flow. And so my whole point is, and then you look at places like MIT, which are basically just, you know, an arm of the military industrial complex. If you took those resources, the brain power at MIT, and you began to develop alternate energies and things like that, we wouldn't be in a situation where we need to go invade countries to take their resources. And the whole idea of free trade, I don't see that. I see basically the military as being sort of the enforcer wing of a fascist government.
Okay. That's got to be one for you, Owen Cote, as a spokesman for the military-industrial complex.
As Larry said earlier, there is one small point that I agree on here, which is that, and I'm going to put it in words that are a little different than the caller used, but there are many ways in which it's kind of absurd to talk about the fact that the U.S. military defends the country in the way most countries think of that. Most countries are in the situation where they actually have a border and they have enemies on the other side and the enemy has an army and the enemy could. We don't have that. We are, by almost every standard, an unbelievably secure country. And the one thing that's changed that and the one thing that everybody's arguing about is 9/11. That's just the big exception, this new kind of terrorism.
Max Boot, there's a sense of inevitability in a way about the debate we're having at the moment. I mean, ever since the Bush administration signed up to the doctrine of preemptive military strikes, it was inevitable that the United States were going to have a larger army.
I don't think that the Bush administration has accepted that inevitability yet, unfortunately. I think there was a lot of hope early in the Bush administration that the revolution in military affairs, various advances in technology, would allow us to do more with less. And that's definitely true in the conventional high-end warfighting that we saw, for example, during the recent Gulf War, the second Gulf War, where we were able to achieve much greater results faster with fewer forces than we had in the first Gulf War. But unfortunately, as we're now seeing, peacekeeping, stability operations, nation building, those kinds of tasks do not have an easy technological fix. They require boots on the ground and lots of them. And unfortunately, we don't have enough boots on the ground. And we need both the technology, but also the boots on the ground. And when you go from 18 active duty divisions in 1991 to 10 today, that doesn't give you enough manpower to police all these trouble spots around the world where we're committed.
Lawrence Korb?
Well, I think you got to make sure you have the right type of troops to go in there. I mean, if we're going to do a lot of this peacekeeping, we're going to have a different kind of army, not a bigger army. It's a different kind. You're going to have people focused on that know how to do it. These divisions that we have are basically structured to fight major conventional battles. And as Max said, they did a terrific job when they went streaming into Baghdad. But now you've got people you spend sometimes millions of dollars training doing police work. And I think you're going to have to, look at it differently. And if you want to do this all by yourself, yes, you're going to need, more boots on the ground. You're going to need more different type of forces. But to take, the 3rd Infantry Division, the 4th Infantry Division, the 1st Armored Cavalry, and having them doing this is just really a waste of resources.
Lawrence Korb, many thanks. Lawrence Korb, Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and former Assistant Secretary of Defense. Many thanks to you too, Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And thanks to you, Max Boot, Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Continue the conversation at our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look at the ineptitude of dictators' sons. This is On Point. An army spokeswoman says it's just a matter of time before American troops capture Saddam Hussein, but the deposed dictator remains elusive even after his 2 sons were killed last week. According to New Republic associate editor Franklin Foer, it should come as no shock that Saddam has been able to hold out longer than either of his progeny.
Ever since Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, the modern tyrant has inhabited his own comedic archetype, the vainglorious, bumbling buffoon. And ever since, high-minded critics have damned this portrayal as a vacuous diversion from reality. But there's a figure who actually conforms to the Hollywood vision of the slapstick strongman, the dictator's son. It was hardly surprising that U.S. forces killed Uday and Qusay Hussein before their father, or that the brothers picked such an obvious hiding place, a cousin's home. Haplessness is an essential characteristic of the dictator's son in the root of his unwitting comic genius. Almost all modern dictators dream of handing power over to their progeny. But aside from a few exceptions, dictators raise sons who abjectly fail at the family business. In Africa, the children of Jomo Kenyatta, Idi Amin, and Daniel Arap Moi have all made a hash of political careers handed to them on platters. Stalin's son Vasily died a miserable drunk. Despite inheriting his father's goon squad, baby Doc couldn't hold Haiti for a third generation of Duvaliers. And after failing in a military career, Augusto Pinochet's boy now wants to exploit his father's infamy by marketing Pinochet brand credit cards and Don Augusto wine. Their failure has nothing to do with diminished capacity for evil. As far as I can discern, no dictator has ever raised a mensch. The biggest difference between father and son is the application of violence. Where the fathers calculatingly use rape, torture, and murder to tighten their grip on power, the sons throw bratty temper tantrums. Uday Hussein was especially prone to flying off the handle. Upon learning that a servant had helped Saddam's liaison with a mistress, Uday shot the underling dead in front of foreign dignitaries. The son of Liberian strongman Charles Taylor, Chucky, reportedly flogged his chauffeur to death after the driver accidentally hit a dog and scratched his car. Dictator sons are often done in by their lifestyles. Almost to a man, they have drinking and drug problems. These weaknesses might be surmountable if the sons devoted themselves to political machination. But most sons of dictators would rather pursue vanity projects than expend shoe leather on brutal power wielding. Because they have the power to do whatever they want, they fulfill every male's fantasy of becoming sports stars and impresarios. Marko Milosevic raced cars, and Baby Doc raced motorcycles, using the palace gardens as a practice track. But soccer is the favorite pastime of the dictator's son. Both Uday Hussein and Saadi Gaddafi spent vast time and resources personally overseeing their national teams. Saadi has humbly selected himself to start in the Libyan national squad's midfield. It's far from clear that he deserves the spot. But when he plays, he often looks like Maradona. That's because his opponents usually position themselves as far as possible from him on the pitch. Referees gift his club all sorts of absurd calls, and Libyans have learned the hard way not to protest any of this. In 1996, after fans booed the biased refereeing, Saadi's bodyguards responded by spraying the stands with gunfire. Why do these sons turn out so badly? It will probably not surprise you to learn that dictators make bad dads. When Vasily Stalin's teacher sent Papa Joe a letter informing him that his son had composed a suicidal note, it took the tyrant 33 months to reply. And most devastatingly, Stalin refused a proposed prisoner swap that would release his son Yakov from a German POW camp. Yakov died in captivity. If dictators were truly serious about keeping power in their family, they would forget about their sons and focus on their daughters. Indonesia is now ruled by President-for-Life Sukarno's daughter, Megawati Sukarnoputri. Benazir Bhutto has followed her authoritarian father in and out of the Pakistani prime ministry. Bangladeshi politics have been similarly dominated by the daughters of strong men. There's an important difference between these fathers and their daughters. The daughters are less inclined to torture, more prone to compromise, more liberal. Take it away, Carol Gilligan.
Franklin Foer is associate editor for The New Republic. He lives in Washington, D.C. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT.